With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to the Mini Break, your daily podcast for the big storylines, results, and controversies from the tennis world. Today is Tuesday, April 30th. These have been busy times for us here at Cracked Rackets as we prepare for our extensive coverage of the 2024 college tennis postseason. It was the ultimate professional thrill to be asked to be a part of yesterday's 2024 NCAA tournament selection shows. It was also such a thrill to be able to offer extensive reactions to those NCAA tournament draws on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel alongside our two other Cracked Rackets experts, John Parsons, Chris Halioris. By the way, if you have missed out on anything in this 2024 college tennis season, we're going to catch you up throughout the course of this week. We will have live shows each and every night, 9 p.m. Eastern time, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, leading up to the start of the NCAA tournament on Friday. We will also have round one and round two coverage on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We will also have coverage of next weekend's Super Regionals, of course. Then our coverage will pivot on over to ESPN Plus for coverage of the final rounds of the NCAA tournament. Again, May is my favorite month on the tennis calendar. May Madness is ahead in the college tennis universe. Coverage, again, going to be available on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel and over on the Great Shot podcast feed, of course. May Madness applies to the pro tennis universe as well. It is a busy month on the calendar. Right now, we're in the midst of a 1,000-level event in Madrid. We've got 1,000-level action in Rome still on the calendar, and of course, looming above all else, the start of the year's second major, the French Open, beginning at the end of May. Only three, 4 more weeks, whatever it is, of data points going to be available to us before we have to have our takes prepared for the year's second major. It's my favorite month on the tennis calendar. No matter what level of the sport you are a fan of, there is something there for you to get excited about. On today's show, I want to catch up on everything that's unfolded in Madrid. I'm going to offer my thoughts on the ATP side of things here on this edition of the show. I will have a second episode out for all of you later, covering everything happening on the WTA side of things. So many headlines to get to. It always helps that we have just about every one of the best players in the world competing this week in Madrid. And look, I think if you were making a rundown of top 10 things to know, most prevalent of all is that Alcaraz, Sinner, Medvedev, they all continue to win. But there's one storyline that looms above everything else, men's, women's side, doesn't matter, that we've seen in Madrid so far this week. It's the return of Rafael Nadal, and I want to spend some time on this episode of the show talking about what I've seen from Rafa so far in his return. Is it the best version of Rafa we've ever seen? No one would accuse him of that, but the way he competes has never changed. That's why for Rafa it's been so frustrating, or why he's had to pull the ripcord on proposed returns to the tour so far this year and over these past couple of years as he's been dealing with injury, because unless he's able to compete at the 110% version of himself that he just has to be mentally satisfied while out on court, he's not going to be on court. And he's not going to put himself in a compromised position. That's just not who Rafa is. And thus, even if, again, physically he has diminished mentally and, you know, emotionally, spiritually, he is still Rafael Nadal, and the return of his presence, it just matters. It transcends the sport because of the excitement he has generated for two decades now for tennis fans. And again, it's been the ultimate thrill to see him return. Now, what have I seen from a tennis perspective? What should we expect from him moving forward? That's an open discussion that I want to offer my thoughts on here on today's show. So yeah, some thoughts on Rafa at the top of today's episode. Then we can get into things like the continued success of guys like Jannik Sinner, Carlos Alcaraz, Daniil Medvedev. How about big weeks at the highest level for an Andrei Rublev, who, oh my God, needed this week more than anything. Even a Taylor Fritz. Yeah, all the success at the 250s over the past 2.5 years for Fritz. He's not going to fall outside of the top 20 of the rankings, but he certainly has fallen out of the top 10. He certainly has fallen out of that top 8 discussion. And to have a big week like he's had in Madrid, certainly encouraging for him as he heads towards the French Open. And then more importantly, a second half of the season, which just from a surface perspective, he always has to attack if he wants to be in that top 8 discussion. Fritz, Rublev, resurgent weeks. It's one of those weeks for Francisco Cerúndolo as well. And, you know, again, even in losses, I think guys like Ben Shelton, Sebastian Korda, Cam Norrie gave you things to get excited about. Another good week for young Italians. Jakub Menchik continues his strong start. Continues his surge, I should say, up the ATP rankings. A lot of fun data points offered to us by this ATP Madrid event, so I want to break down all of them here on today's show. Again, I will be back a little bit later in the day to break down all things happening on the WTA side of things. We'll get into the IGA of it all, the Sabalenkas, a resurgent Jabeur, and so much more. Going to be a fun day of podcasting as, again, not only want to talk about everything happening in the Pro Tour, but we'll have another live show for all of you tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern Time on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel, breaking down the NCAA Women's Singles Draw. A shout out to our super producer, Daniel Westhoff, who will just be working his tail off over the course of the next month to prepare and produce all of the content for all of you tennis fans to enjoy. A thank you to him. A thank you as well to the support we get from our friends at Tennis Point, tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15 for all of the latest and greatest products in the tennis world. Excuse me. With that said, let's get into it. Let's talk all things ATP Madrid. Have to start with my reaction to Rafa's run. Beyond even the tennis we've seen or the state of Rafa's game, let's start by addressing what a delight it is to have the competitor that is Rafael Nadal back into our lives. There's just something so captivating, so compelling about the sequence of fist pumps he fires off after every successful big point, about the sequence of ticks he has, right, on each and every point as well, the combing over the ear, the pulling and adjusting of the shorts, the different things he does with the water bottles, etc., on the bench, those little ticks, again, those little nuances. That's what I love about sport. That's what I love about watching these athletes, the length they go to bring their best to the court. And again, it is clearly a physically diminished Rafael Nadal out on court, but spiritually, emotionally, the fight is still so thoroughly there, and it just puts a fire in your belly. Even if you're not playing, even if you're just like us spectators watching him compete, I mean, to see Pedro Cachin after the match say, hey, you know, can we swap jerseys? Can I get a shirt? You've meant so much to me throughout the course of my career to have the opportunity to play you, the ultimate thrill. It just speaks to what Rafael Nadal has meant to this sport now for 2 decades. And to see any version of him on court, we should celebrate that fact, even if it's not the Rafael Nadal of his prime years. Now, let's spend some time addressing the tennis we have seen from the former world number one. There are some differences. He has always used that high, elevated backhand line shot, particularly against Roger Federer, with effect as a resetting shot in the point. But the way he has to play that high backhand line when he's pushed into that backhand corner, that is a defensive mechanism that unfortunately I think he is forced to turn to just because he is compromised from a movement perspective. Rafa is clearly right now not as fluid getting in and out of corners. It helps that he's able to slide into his shot. And again, he has probably the best footwork of anyone we've ever seen on the clay court. So he is able to still time things I mean, again, it's going to be more effective than 99.9% of players because he's still Rafael Nadal, but it's not vintage Rafael Nadal out there moving in and out of corners. I think his movement into that backhand corner is particularly compromised. He's just not getting there fully with the time he's accustomed to having, and thus he is forced to play a little bit more defensively. And again, the defensive mechanism he turns to isn't typically the slice. It's not going backhand cross. When he has time to set his feet, of course he will still rip that backhand cross with confidence. And how he's gotten more aggressive with that backhand down the later half of his career is why he was able to extend his run at the top of the game, or one of the reasons why so successfully. But now he has to play that high, elevated, loopy backhand line that, again, is daring opponents. Take that ball early on the rise. Test his on-the-run forehand. And more than anything, I do think Rafa wants to keep that ball in front of him. He is always. That's why that defense mechanism has been so successful for him. It's because, yeah, I dare you. I'm baiting you. Try and take that backhand early on the rise, cross-court. Test my on-the-run forehand. If Rafa gets a clean look at his on-the-run forehand on clay, it's the best shot we've ever seen on the surface ever. And even in this diminished form physically, because he anticipates so well, because again, all he has to do is get his racket on the ball and he can come up with something special with that on the run forehand wing, he's still been able to have plenty of success with that shot. The defensive mechanism, at least against opponents who attack in the way Demonauer, Blanche, and Kashin do on their backhand wings, he's been fairly successful with it. You know, that said, again, neither Kashin, Demonauer, Blanche are particularly comfortable taking that on-the-rise backhand line. And again, it's a really hard shot to take on the rise backhand line because you are trying to elevate that ball over the highest portion of the net, and because you have to flatten that ball out because you're taking it on the rise, because it's a little bit harder to take it on the rise ball and manufacture the sort of topspin you'd be able to if it was hip height and not shoulder height, where you're trying to flatten it out. You know, it's flattened out, so the net clearance is going to be a little bit lower. It's more of a line drive shot. And, you know, again, Demonauer, Kashin, Blanche, they didn't have that shot in the bag, in their bags, excuse me, to the extent or with the consistency that they needed to hit the ball behind Rafa, which to me, I think that's the tactic. If you're attacking this version of Rafael Nadal, the ball behind Rafa, particularly on that backhand wing, although he is doing a good job protecting it and again, kind of baiting you take on his forehand on the run. I just think I'm waiting for someone to say, okay, I'm going to test that forehand on the run. And I think to some extent, Pedro Kashin did. Now, again, his backhand just, and same with Demonauer to some extent in this Madrid match, although Demonauer, his version of hit the ball behind Rafa was to incorporate the drop shot, and I think that's going to be a really successful tactic that we see more players begin to incorporate against this version of Rafa if he continues to play throughout the course of the month. But, you know, again, Yuri Lehechka is a guy who could hit through the ball cross-court with his backhand, and obviously it's going to be Rafa's fourth match in 8-9 days. You have to wonder how he is feeling physically, how his body will recover after the three sets against Pedro Kashin. But that's the first guy with real weapons who I'm curious to see how Rafa's on-the-run forehand holds up against. I mean, here's the thing. Again, I'm talking about Rafa's weaknesses there for my first 4 minutes in addressing what you see with this version of Rafa. And to me, that's the first thing that sticks out is, oh, that feels like that pushing him into the backhand corner. You know, again, in theory, that's always been attackable, but not actually, because he recovered so well to that forehand wing, because, again, he's baiting you into hitting that backhand cross, into going into a rally with his forehand, where then he's going to go forehand cross, forehand line, inside out forehand, inside in forehand. And by the way, if you're still alive in the rally, because he hasn't hit a winner yet, at that point, your legs are completely gassed. And we know the Rafa patterns. That's what he does with that backhand line, or that's what he has done with that backhand line throughout the course of his career, is bait you into trying to test his forehand. I just think you're going to be able to test that on the run forehand and generate errors for him, or at least defensive balls left short more successfully, that then will allow you to attack through his backhand corner again more successfully. He's just not moving as well to the backhand corner. And by the way, he's 38 years old, or turns 38, excuse me, on June 3rd. He shouldn't be moving to his backhand corner anymore as well as he once did. That's maybe where the attack, where you can attack Rafa in ways you once weren't able to, or at least the difference I see. But what is he doing right? It's the chutzpah behind the serve, behind the plus one aggression, how consistently he hits his spots, and again, how well he knows precisely what spots he wants to execute towards. Obviously, the slice serve wide on the ad side to set up the plus one inside out forehand, or again, if he catches you cheating too far going towards that plus one inside out forehand, obviously he can just rip it inside in right behind you as well, find that short angle. Again, if you manage to get something to his backhand when he has time, his ability to hit that plus one cross, it does have a little bit more pace. That does feel like he's swinging a little bit harder, trying to do a little bit more with that first strike. I mean, it helps that in these last two matches against Cashin, he made 78% of his first serves. Against Demonauer, he made 73. He's so precise with the spots that he's hitting right now. If you can get him on the defense, again, his ability to recover from those positions, not nearly what it once was, but if you do leave something hanging, he's still Rafael Nadal, and if he gets there with his feet set, he's going to pass you. You know, I went on Second Serve, Tennis Channel's T2 show. It's always a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to go on there. And Jason Goodall was kind enough to ask me, do I think Rafael Nadal will be seated at the French Open? And do I think Rafael Nadal should be seated at the French Open? Which are two different questions, because should he be seated is asking, hey, is this guy one of the 32 best clay court players in the world right now? Will he be seeded is a question of, is it better for the French Tennis Federation to protect Rafa's first round match, to try and make it a little bit easier for him to progress through the draw, to continue to put butts in seats? And oh, by the way, this is a guy who has been more successful at the French Open than maybe any athlete has been successful at any venue or at any event in the course of athletics, the history of sport. Like, that's Rafa at the French Open. Maybe, again, you put Phelps in Beijing, Usain Bolt's run as the fastest man in the world in my lifetime. You know, I can't get into the Carl Lewis and et cetera of it all because I wasn't there for it, and I don't know the history as well. You know, again, Tom Brady, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods at his best. Obviously, Federer at his best at Wimbledon, Djokovic in Australia. But if you're doing tennis specific, Rafa's run at the French Open is better than anyone at any major in any history ever. And again, athletics, like, I think it's one of the best records we have across any sport in the history of sport. That would be the case for why he's a top 32 seed at the French Open if he's able in the, or if he's in the draw. You just have to respect the pedigree, the track record. That's the will he be. I do think he'll be a top 32 seed, even if it's like 28 or 29. I think this run in Madrid is probably just enough to justify that and just sneak a number next to him. Should he be a top 32 seed? I'm still not convinced. Like, yeah, he beats Demonauer, but again, he had played Demonauer the week prior in Barcelona. It's really hard to beat any player who's healthy and playing 2 weeks consecutively, particularly one that's Rafael Nadal's level. Like, this is still top 50 clay court tennis. He executes too well behind his first serve, behind his plus one arsenal, to not be, if he's physically healthy, like, he has to be respected as one of the 50 best clay court players in the world. But 3 out of 5 sets, like, will he be able to sustain that execution, not just over the course of one round, but over the course of an opening week, the way, you know, a seed is expected to win their first two matches, progress to that third round? Do I think Rafa can sustain that level for, I don't think he's going to win every match in straight sets. So we'll say, can he play 14 sets of tennis over 5 days at a top 32 level? I mean, he's played what? He's played 7 sets of tennis over 6 days to at a top 50 level, certainly. It's tough. I'd say yes, but just by the thinnest of margins. Just because of what the track record is, the pedigree, the fact that opponents still mentally are lining up against the opposite side, and it's Rafael freaking Nadal at Roland Garros that you're facing against. Just ask Pedro Cachin. I think you saw those yips, how tentative he got with his backhand in that third set. Kind of indicative of the mental hurdle that is playing Rafa, by the way, Demonauer. I mean, he's playing in Madrid, which is a home crowd for Rafa, but the French Open's also going to be a home crowd for Rafael Nadal. I'm going to say this run, he's been just good enough to justify a seat if he is ultimately granted one. Now, if it's in the top 20, that's crazy. But if it's anything below 25, that's fine with me because I do think Rafa is able to play top 32 tennis. I just don't know if he's going to be able to do it again over the course of 14 sets, over the course of 5 days, or, you know, again, certainly if he wants to win the tournament. I'm not nearly ready to discuss the idea of Rafa winning the 2024 French Open. I got to see him recover well and beat a guy in Jiří Lehečka who, again, is going to have real weapons to test Rafael Nadal's physicality, test his fluidity in and out of corners, and, again, test those legs after three significantly Darwin Blanche aside, 2 hours against Demonauer, 3 hours, 4 minutes yesterday against Kashin, and, you know, again, now he's the night match against Jiří Lehečka. Yeah, the crowd will be him to spur him on. Again, the match hasn't been played. If something particularly notable happens, there's a withdrawal or, God forbid, some sort of injury that occurs, or if Rafa does the magnificent, comes out and gives Lehečka the business, I will address that on part two of today's shows. But it depends what your expectations were. Like, I was going to offer Rafa a final grade as you look at these first three matches in Madrid. I mean, he won his first three matches, so in that sense, he's still advanced in the tournament. I don't know how at this version, given the injuries he's been through, you give anything lower than an A-. That said, the tennis he's playing itself, B, like maybe B+. Like, yeah, again, it's looked good when in rhythm. It's when the ball's not in front of him, when he's forced to improvise that. There are times he looks like he's 37 years old and has gone through a bunch of different surgeries. And again, that's where it gets back to what are your expectations for Rafa at this point. My expectation is just to thoroughly enjoy the excitement he brings every time he steps on the court. And if that is the metric you are grading his performance on this week in Madrid, it's not an equivocal A+, as we have seen the return of shades of vintage Rafa, the competitor, throughout the course of his run to the round of 16. Again, a matchup with Jiří Lehečka now awaiting him here on Tuesday afternoon here on the East Coast of the United States, or Tuesday night over in Madrid. That's your biggest headline, no doubt about it, but let's break down the rest of the nuances of what's unfolded on the ATP side of things in Madrid. To me, the biggest storyline, and one of the players I probably didn't spend enough time examining over the course of the 2023 offseason heading into 2024 and saying, hey, like, who are you going to be moving forward? And this should be a make or break year in terms of kind of setting the bar of what to expect from this player moving forward. I should have talked more about Francisco Cerúndolo over the course of the offseason, because Cerúndolo is one of those captivating talents, like an Alejandro Davidovich Fokina, like the best versions of a Denis Shapovalov, two guys who I claimed had make-or-break seasons ahead of them here in 2024 in terms of my expectations for them moving forward. Even Amir Kecmanovic, like, I think that's another guy. These early to mid-20s, 23 to 25 by age guys who have all flashed top 10 tennis at times, and yet, whether it's from a consistency week-in, week-out standpoint, whether it's injuries, whatever it may be, they just haven't consolidated their positions in the rankings quite yet early in their careers. And look, Francisco Cerúndolo turns 26 this August, and to some extent he has. Like, for 2 years now, he's clearly been a top 50 guy. For about a year consecutively, he's floated in that top 32 range. He's 36 and 26 overall over his last 52 weeks. Again, you win 60% of your matches, as he's just about doing, you're going to hold pretty firm. You're not going to rise, but you're going to hold pretty firm where you are in the rankings. And again, during this stretch of time, seven different quarterfinals for him at the tour level now. If you include his run now in Madrid, he's made quarterfinals at the Rome Masters last year, Madrid Masters obviously this year, the Rio 500 in February, Bucharest in April. By the way, for what it's worth, six of his seven quarterfinals over these last 52 weeks on clay. But of course, we've seen him make runs at Miami as well, when his forehand is firing. That weapon can just be captivating in a way that few other forehands on the tour can. And again, technically, The backhand is sound. He can hit the slice well. He can flatten it out and go line. He's comfortable playing it cross. He's comfortable hitting it through the court cross. He's comfortable playing the drop shot. I think he moves pretty well to that side. This is a guy, Argentinian, grew up on the clay courts. You see that in the fluidity of his movement on the surface. Again, a guy who slides into his shots, not out of them. A guy who can hit the big first serve, but that first serve percentage at 65.7%, like, I think that's a little bit misleading. This guy who wins 2/3 of his first serve points, which is outside the top 25 of top 50 players, under 50% on the second serve. He just gets a little bit sloppy behind that first serve because the first forehand, like, yes, when he hits a good first serve and it's an easy first forehand, he will finish it successfully. If you test him with the return of serve, get that ball on his body or rush him a little bit, he's still going to try and take that big plus one first forehand cut, and there are just some weeks or some matches where that first forehand is off. You look for Cirundolo. Interesting. 18-9 in first matches over his last 52 weeks, but it kind of runs in spurts because there was a stretch last year where he won 7 first matches consecutively and had a really good streak last summer where he played really good ball at Eastbourne, Queen's Club, Roland Garros, Wimbledon, etc. You know, after that, you look for him down the home stretch of last season to start this season. He lost 6 of 8 first-round matches from Tokyo last year to the start of Rio this year. It just can run a little bit of hot and cold for Francisco Cirundolo. And again, I just think that's because there are times when he's just impatient out on court where, again, because he has those big weapons, he wants to rush to use them when he doesn't need to do that. He has the physicality. He can hit the three-quarter pace ball that eventually will manufacture the opportunity he is looking for to step into that forehand and utilize it as the weapon it can be. That's what he's done this week. I mean, again, he's played fantastic tennis. 3 really impressive victories over Fabian Marizan, Tommy Paul, and now Sasha Zverev to advance to these quarterfinals. I mean, today against Zverev, he just was. It was one of those days where he was. And this is why I think he gets so impatient, because it's on a day like today where he wins that match 3-4. He faced just 2 break points throughout the course of the match. The pace of his forehand, it just overwhelmed everything Sasha Zverev wanted to do on his forehand wing. Zverev was pushed so far behind the baseline, was just never really able to implement any sort of weight of shot in his return games. And when Cirundolo is dictating like that, he becomes that much more dangerous because now he can take some bigger cuts on the return of serve, step into forehands, and try to pressure that Zverev forehand, which he did so successfully in getting Zverev to pop that ball up right in his strike zone, and then Cirundolo flattening out that forehand like a cannon. I mean, it was the same thing against Tommy Paul, and that one was a little bit of a slower burn. Obviously, Cirundolo kind of handed that first set back to Tommy Paul, but ultimately, again, found the forehand, 6-7, 6-4, 6-2, was just able to wear Tommy Paul down with the weight of his shot. This is the ceiling. This is the upside. The Argentinian has flashed, again, multiple times in his career. I know his biggest title, what, he's won 2 tour-level titles, one in Bostad back in 2022, one in Eastbourne last year, where he played that another really fun match with Tommy Paul, as they did today. But you look at what this guy has done in his career, again, at the Masters. He's made the semifinals of a Miami Masters event, quarterfinals in Madrid, Rome, Miami, 2 separate times. Like, you look at what he's done at the majors in his career, that's where things are a little bit lacking. Only 1 second week, and it came at last year's Roland Garros, where, again, he was playing the best tennis of his career. That's underwhelming for a guy who turns 26 years old and has flashed top 10 tennis on multiple different occasions. I'm curious, what's his record against top 20 opponents in his career? Francisco Cirundolo, 16-22 against top 20 opponents in his career. That's really good for a guy who has never been ranked higher than 19. I mean, again, I know it's under 500. You're hearing 16 and 22, a 42% win percentage against top 20 opponents, and you're saying that's really good, Alex? Yeah, that is really good. Most people don't flirt with 500 ball against top 20 opponents. And when you keep in mind that Cirundolo lost his first 3 matchups against top 20 opponents to Diego Schwartzman, he lost 6 of his first 8 as well. So what, you take 2 and 6 away, he's 14 and 16 over that stretch of time since he's essentially 500 against top 20 players. That's the problem, is the variation, the delta between ceiling and floor is so large. And again, that inconsistency on the days when the plus one isn't working, when Cirundolo's just a little bit impatient or not present mentally, that's when things start to misfire. When he's fired up, when he has the opportunity to play the big dogs again, he is capable of matching that level again. He lost four straight against top 20 opponents coming into this weekend. Madrid now gets wins over Tommy Paul, Sasha Zverev, into the quarterfinals where, dare I say, he'll be the favorite over Taylor Fritz in that quarterfinal, just giving the, dare I say, delta in 1,000-level success between the two, or the delta in clay court experience. Again, Cirundolo's resume and ascent into the top 100 built upon a foundation of challenger clay court success. But it's one of those Cirundolo weeks where it's just a reminder of the weapons he possesses, the innate physicality that he is capable of playing with when he is disciplined, when he is willing to physically suffer throughout the course of a match. And he was willing to do that against Tommy Paul. He was willing to do that against Sasha Zverev. That's why he was able to advance to the quarterfinals this week. It was a reminder of his ceiling and a reminder that we should expect more of Francisco Cirundolo, because again, this isn't the first time he's earned not just a top 20 win, but actually, is this the first time in his career? It is the second time in his career he has earned multiple top 20 wins in a single event. He did it in Madrid, here again, wins over Zverev and Paul. 2022 Miami, he beat Riley Opelka, blast from the past, and Jannik Sinner. Oh, he also did it in Bostad 2022, beat Casper Ruud, Pablo Carreño Busta on his way to that title. It's the only two times in his career he has earned multiple top 20 victories in a single event. We should expect more than that from Francisco Cirundolo, because again, 16-22 in his career against top 20 opponents, that's a pretty good freaking record. And the weapons are there. The skill set is there. The physicality is there. It's been one of those weeks for Francisco Cirundolo, and he's back on the radar. This is a reminder. You know what? It's a mid-season addition to the make-or-break list, but he's back on the make-or-break list because this is a guy who is capable of playing top 15 tennis. Is there really that big of a gap between his ceiling, a Taylor Fritz's ceiling, a Tommy Paul's ceiling right now? Just, again, even on the best days in a physical match against a Hubie Hurkacz, it feels like Cirundolo, if he's not pushing those guys more consistently by the end of this season, maybe it is time to say, okay, maybe he's never going to quite get to that level. Maybe 20 to 40 in the rankings is more where he's going to be floating throughout the course of his prime, which, by the way, it's a very good career. Probably with how Grand Slams pay at this point, he's not going to need a second job in his lifetime. Still, what is that ceiling moving forward? Again, this is a guy who made a breakthrough into the top 100 a little bit later in his career than some, and yet the weapons remain captivating enough that after one of these weeks from Francisco Cirundolo, he now has my attention. Anyways, there's 10 minutes on Francisco Cirundolo. You're not going to get that on any other show. Didn't you miss it when we had those sorts of tangents here on this podcast? Let's talk about the rest of the things we've learned from Madrid. Let's start now with resurgent weeks from Andre Rublev, Taylor Fritz. Let's start on the Rublev side of things. Oh my God, did he need this quarterfinal, his first since his run in Dubai back in February. Straight set wins for him over Facundo Bagnis, Alejandro Davidovich Fokina, Talon Griekspoor. And the big thing for me, excluding the Davidovich Fokina first set, where I don't want to say he got off to a slow start, but he wasn't playing elite tennis, he started off hot in his matches against Griekspoor and Bagnis, and that just hasn't been the case this year. It feels like every match I've watched Rublev play, he's been down an early break 3-1, or, you know, again, down an early break 4-2, breaks there, but then immediately broken back for 3-all in that first set, and it's just taken him a while to find his bearings. Hasn't been the case this week. He got broken once against Facundo Bagnis, wasn't until the second set, got broken once against Davidovich Fokina, fought off 5 of 6 break points. By the way, didn't face a break point, won 97% of his first serve points against Talon Griekspoor, a Griekspoor who had just beaten Runa the round before, and it's just back to the basics. Serve wide first forehand to the open court, backhand line to set up the forehand inside out, to set up the forehand inside in, to set up just the forehand finisher. confidence moving forward, higher first serve percentages. He's made over two-thirds of his first serves in every match that he played. He had done that just once between that run in Dubai and the start of his run here in Madrid. By the way, it's amazing what Kjaer just making your first serve can do for the rest of your game, particularly for a guy in Andrei Rublev who is so first strike centric. And because he's having success behind the first serve, just opens everything else up that he wants to do, can take that return a little bit earlier inside the baseline, and then, you know, again, hold his positioning a little bit more comfortably, knowing, okay, my second ball in the rally is going to be a forehand. And again, the moment Andrei Rublev gets a forehand with his feet set, I don't care who the opponent is, he's in control of the point. It's a very simple fix. He is serving better this week than he has since Dubai, and now he's back on his front foot, and now he's back in control, and now he's back into the quarterfinals of an event for the first time since February. And again, it's precisely what the doctor ordered for the 26-year-old world number 8 into the quarterfinals, where a date with world number 2 Carlos Alcaraz awaits. We'll get to him in a moment, the other guy who's had a resurgent week again. How about Taylor Fritz? Wins over Luciano Dardari, who, again, the rising Italian, won his first 250 title on clay courts earlier this year in South America. Also had pretty good run in Houston to the semifinals. Fritz knocks him out 6-4 on his way to the quarterfinals of this event in round number 1. Then how about these wins? 2-3 over South American clay court superstar Sebi Baez, a match where he faced no break points. 6-4 win against 8th-seeded Hubi Hurkacz, a match where he faced no break points. He's faced just 2 break points this week in Madrid. I don't care. Surface, elevation. You can make all these different cases for why that might be the case. Doesn't make it any less impressive from Taylor Fritz. He's faced just 2 break points. He's been just broken once after facing 2 top 20 players in Hubi Hurkacz, Sebi Baez, and again, dare I say, another pretty clear-cut top 50 clay court guy in the young Italian Luciano Dardari. The key thing is how well Fritz is moving on this surface. Is he a guy who slides into his shots? No. Does he look like a fish out of water trying to get out of his corners? Not nearly the way he did even as recently as 2022, or dare I say, even as recently as last week in Monte Carlo. It just feels like, okay, he's a little bit more comfortable now on the surface. And, you know, again, when he's able to keep the ball in front of him, the weight of his shot on this surface is just so difficult to deal with. And look, Taylor Fritz, when he can get his hands on the ball cleanly, he's always been precise with his ground strokes. And, you know, you think about Taylor Fritz, you think about, again, the size, the weapons, his ability to flatten the ball out, his ability to drive that ball forehand or backhand wing through the court. My favorite thing about Taylor Fritz's ground strokes are how easily it is for him to go off speed, for him to flick the wrist forehand wing, or again, give you that little flick short angle backhand side as well to open up space for him to drive through the court line, or again, how well he gets outside the ball to really get a cross court forehand outside the alley, or really get a backhand cross court into your backhand wing and prevent you from cheating over and camping on the backhand forehand inside outside like Baez likes to do, like Hurkacz likes to do, like Dardari likes to do. The strength of Fritz's weapons, the weight of that shot, again, just keeps you off balance, keeps you uncomfortable. And the big thing for him, it hasn't been first serve percentage as simple as Andrei Rublev. He just looks more comfortable moving on this surface right now than he did a couple of weeks ago in Monte Carlo. And again, I didn't talk about this because I was a little lazy with the podcasting last week, but it's that it's a second week in a row. It's that he looked this comfortable in Munich and wins over Draper, over Christian Garin. Now that he's doing this against guys like Baez, Dardari, Hurkacz as well, it's just proof that that weight of shot is real, that the impact it's having, the fact that it's just pushing his opponents back, and now he does get to be on his front foot. More importantly, though, he gets to keep the ball in front of him, and it's a little bit more difficult for opponents to expose that lack of fluidity in his hips on this surface in particular. That weight of shot for Fritz is just devastating. And again, Madrid might amplify his strengths. We're going to have that discussion separately. But two guys who really needed big runs at this level and needed a couple of top 20 wins. Taylor Fritz, Andrei Rublev. Fritz certainly getting his wins over Baez, Hurkacz to advance to the quarterfinals, where a date with the big hitting Francisco Cerúndolo awaits. Those are the resurgent stories. Again, headlines at the top. Alcaraz, Sinner, Medvedev, they've all looked the part of tier one contenders as they have all season long. I know Sinner, a little banged up in his 5-7, 6-3, 6-3 victory over Karen Khachanov. That continues to remain the only concern as it relates to Jannik Sinner's future. This is a guy who's dealt with some injury issues who, again, he's a little skinny. He's a little frail. And you rack up a lot of matches on the body, the nicks and bruises. It feels like they can add up at times for Jannik Sinner, who still just 22 years old, still clearly growing into his body, still maturing physically, developing that sort of muscle and the callus. The muscle callus is not the right word I'm looking for. But again, that sort of depth of muscle, or again, the physicality you need to just sustain that level for an 11-month consecutive period like this season truly is. And yet even through that, again, 2-5 over Pavel Kotov in round 0-3 over Sonego, 2-5 over Kotov, 5-7, 6-3, 6-3 over Karen Khachanov, who, by the way, continues to play top-8 level tennis. He is the top-8 player who lacks top-8 results to be firmly ensconced in that discussion, because his ranking of 17 hasn't allowed him to quite get to the quarters or semifinals of big events that he'd need to make that final jump in the rankings-wise that would be indicative of the level that he's played at. But again, this season, round of 16 Australian Open, he loses to Sinner, but he lost to Sinner. And he happened to draw him in round of 16. Semifinals, Dimitrov lost in Marseille. He wins Doha. We'll throw out Dubai because it was the next week. Bad loss in Indian Wells, but round of 16 loss, that's when he played Zverev at Miami. Quarterfinal loss, that's when he played Tsitsipas in Monte Carlo, but he beat Medvedev there. Again, three-set loss, yes, to Jannik Sinner, where he was 0-3 in the three breakpoint Sinner had. He was able to convert, but Khachanov's 32-17 overall, flirting with that two-thirds rule that allows you to continue to ascend the rankings no matter where you are in them. I'm just saying, he is playing top-8 level tennis, even if he doesn't have that top-8 headline, like semifinal of a master or final of a 500 or whatever, you know, again, quarterfinal of a major, whatever results you're looking for from a top-8 guy. His level is top-8 level, and yet still, I mean, the weight of shot for Jannik Sinner, how well he moves on this surface, his fluidity, again, able to slide into the ball and, you know, again, anticipate so well, can hit every angle, can hit every shot in the book, can play the drop shot, comfortable moving forward, comfortable on the return of serve. He's playing world number one tennis, and again, getting the sort of results a world number one gets, not at his best physically, and yet able to grind through a tough battle with Karen Khachanov to advance to the quarterfinals, where again, a date now awaits, I believe, with Felix Auger-Aliassime did ultimately earn a 6-4, 7-5 win over Casper Ruud. And I mean, talk about, again, a major freaking result. I'm going to have to do some cleanup on that one on our later edition of the show, because I haven't watched the highlights from that. And to be honest, Menchik was in no state physically to compete with Felix in round number three. But for FA, an 0-4 win over an Adrian Mannarino, who's equally fish out of water on this surface, a 4-6, 6-1, 6-4 win over Nishioka in round one. Again, I didn't really learn anything from those matches Felix-wise. That's why I owe you a Felix follow-up, because 4-5 win over a Casper Ruud. I know how much tennis Casper's played to start this clay court season, but that is a signature clay court victory for Felix, one he hasn't gotten maybe ever in his career. So that's significant. And again, now he's going to match up with Jannik Sinner in the quarters, a guy who, for the record, he's 2-0 against in his career. The weight of Felix's shot, his ability to at least try to play on his terms, which you have to try to do against someone like Sinner, because the moment he's dictating from the center of the court, you lose. He's too consistent with those weapons. You know, again, Felix 2-0 over Sinner. That's an interesting note going into that matchup. How healthy is Jannik Sinner? Obviously, Felix doing something right. Oh my God, did he need a result like this? And for Felix now, advancing to the quarterfinals here in Madrid, he is up 8 spots back into the top 32, up to number 27 in the current ATP live rankings. Looking at, again, the other top seeds, Carlos Alcaraz pushed to the brink yesterday, 6-3, 6-7, 7-6. He knocks off Jan-Lennard Struff. It gets back to his power tennis back here on clay courts. You look at just the way Jan-Lennard Struff, he just goes for his cuts. I mean, first of all, that's what you have to do against Carlos Alcaraz. And I've said it before, I'll say it again. When Carlos Alcaraz gets into trouble, it's because the way he tries to get himself out of jams is by hitting through that, is by amplifying his powers, by doubling down on his aggression. And That's not going to work against the pace of Jan-Lennard Struff, against the while you're playing from the compromised positions that, again, Struff's plus one arsenal or Struff's ability, again, the strength of his serve. You know, again, Alcaraz isn't able to take those aggressive positions on the return of serve. He's going to have to be 12 feet behind the baseline as he was if he wants to find a forehand with how heavy the kick of Struff even on the second serve comes in. And then again, Struff has the strength to absorb that pace, particularly on this surface of Alcaraz, try to redirect it, be aggressive with it. He takes time away by serving and volleying and executes the drop volley so well to take advantage of the space Alcaraz provided him. And yet, I mean, in front of that home crowd, Carlito is just electric. And look, yeah, the forehand at times sprayed. He did get a little bit too offensive-centric. He didn't try. I mean, it's hard to extend rallies. Struff played such make-or-break tennis. Like, it was a credit for Struff for imposing his will into that match. And again, whenever we've seen Alcaraz troubled, you think about guys like Struff or Nicolas Jarry. I mean, Zverev and Dimitrov losses of late are kind of different stories because of what those two guys are physically. But you have to be a big hitter. You have to be willing to take those cuts, or you have to be on an elite plane physically the way a guy like Zverev or Dimitrov is if you're going to compete with Carlos Alcaraz. And Jan-Lennard Struff certainly did that still. Alcaraz able to fight off 8 of 10 break points that he faced. And God, he's just getting to see him and Rafa compete in Madrid on the same day. It's just like, if you're going to compare Alcaraz to Rafa at all, it's not about the tennis that they play. It's about the way that they compete. It's about the way they wear themselves and their emotions so thoroughly on their sleeve, and you just feel everything. It's so visceral, those experiences and the emotions that they're going through. Alcaraz was electric. Again, 3-set victory. He advances now to a quarterfinal date with Andrei Rublev. If Rublev gets a win at Alcaraz, are you going to talk yourself into him being another top 8 contender going into the French Open after how disastrous this past 2-month stretch has been for him? If he can rack up a win like that, maybe, given the uncertainty surrounding the rest of the post-Tier 1 field. Certainly Zverev losing again to Francisco Cerúndolo. He has been uninspiring through the past month here on clay courts, and there's not a single result you can turn to yet on his clay court resume that makes you think, oh yeah, this is a guy who can make a third consecutive semifinal at Roland Garros, even if he has been that consistent at that event of late. It's a heck of a run. Again, a really good win for Alcaraz, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing how he recovers and rebounds against Rublev. And then, how about Daniil Medvedev? It's been a weird draw, no doubt, for the number 3 seed, but Medvedev able to earn victories over Sasha Bublik in round 4, Seppi Korda 6-3 in the third in round 3, Matteo Arnaldi 6-4 in the third in round number 2. What does Medvedev need more than anything on these clay courts? He needs wins. Again, this is a guy with fewer than 50 clay court victories in his career at the tour level. You know, again, played just 2 matches in Monte Carlo. Now he's gone 3 sets in 2 of his 3 matches. Has only been broken twice in each of his matches. And again, this is a guy who's outside the top 25 in hold percentage. The serve has been a struggle for him to start the season. You know, again, the first serve percentage, he's been over 60% in 2 of his matches. He was under 60% against Bublik, but I suppose when you're facing Bublik, it's a different objective with the first serve than what you're trying to do in other matches. Still, he just is so much more comfortable moving on this surface. He's a guy who slides out of his shots, but at least now he can slide a little bit more comfortably on this surface. And again, how consistent he is with the backhand wing. I would argue his forehand is actually more effective on clay with how well that cross-court forehand in particular rips through the court. Yeah, the backhand sits up a little bit because of how flat it is, but the depth he generates on that wing, it's still as effective as anything. It's still effective on this surface, even if it isn't quite as effective as on a quicker surface. Still the big thing for him, again, through to a quarterfinal here in Madrid. Can't say that very frequently for Daniil Medvedev in his career on clay courts. In fact, you look for Daniil Medvedev overall now, quarterfinal number 6 in his career on clay courts. It's his 3rd consecutive, by the way. 4 of the 6 now at Masters events. He's done at Monte Carlo twice, Rome, and now here this year in Madrid. His other 2 quarterfinals, Barcelona 2019, and his run to the 2021 Roland Garros quarterfinals, which is, of course, the only time he has reached the quarterfinals at the year's 2nd major. All guys, again, Medvedev needed more match play. Alcaraz with the injury concerns for him to not only get through to the quarterfinals, but to survive a three-set thriller with Struff, excuse me. Good for his level, and then again for Sinner. How healthy is he? If he's healthy, he's playing world number one tennis, and again, continues to get through. Another three-set win for him against Karen Khachanov. Again, the guys at the top continuing to look their best. Your other storylines here quickly thus far in Madrid, and by the way, I'll have a guest later this week, even maybe tomorrow, to help break further storylines down. Hubi consolidates his top eight position. Again, I thought he looked really good in his first two round victories. Daniel Altmaier in round number three. I thought he also looked pretty darn solid in his round one and five win, or round two, excuse me, victory, but first match win over Jack Draper. Again, if Hubi can just rack up round of 16s, quarterfinals during this clay court season, put up top 20 numbers, as he has already a 250 title week number one, and, you know, again, now a run to the round of 16 here in Madrid. If he puts up top 16 numbers or top 20 numbers during the clay court portion of the season, he's going to end up in the tour finals because he is clearly a top eight guy on faster surfaces, obviously hard courts in particular. I don't know if there's a big enough clay grass court sample size to really make a list of who are the best players on grass courts, but certainly if you feel like Hubi's playing profile, his Wimbledon semifinal appearance, he would at least have a resume to be put on the table in that discussion. Anyways, yes, he loses round of 16 to Taylor Fritz. Disappointing, continuing as a 6-4 match, and he didn't have a breakpoint opportunity. But again, if he can put up top 20, top 16 results, that's what he needs to do in this portion of the calendar. And so far, he has done that to keep his tour finals hopes alive. So that's a fun storyline for you. Again, I need to watch more FAA to give you a further update on that. I was really impressed with Jakub Menship. 6-2, 6-7, 6-3 over Grigor Dimitrov. It's the fearlessness with which that he plays, with the decisiveness, again, the willingness to hit the big first serve, hit the big first forehand, be the aggressor, dictate behind what he wants to do. Really impressive stuff, again, in knocking off Dimitrov in three sets. And you look for Jakub Menchik now all the way up to number 65 in the live rankings, youngest player in the top 100, youngest player in the top 75 now as well. Another big result for him as he continues to establish himself on the ATP Tour. Obviously for João Fonseca, knocked out by Cam Norrie, 1-4, but again, he's the prospect I'm probably most excited about right now in the men's game, in the tennis world. I thought Norrie looked pretty good. I know he got knocked out 2-4 pretty routinely by Ruud in round three, but Cam's playing better ball. Like, he's just moving better. He's hitting a little bit more decisively. Again, do his weapons impact players with elite physicality and discipline? Maybe not, but I think his ceiling was always more of the 12 to 25 range than the top 12 level he was flirting with for that year stretch there. And again, 12 to 25, you're making a pretty darn good living for yourself. So I've been impressed by his level of late. Sebi Korda, another one of those just compelling enough results to have our attention. Three sets with Daniil Medvedev. But, you know, again, Korda is a prime candidate for 2025 make or break player list, because at a certain point, you just have to ask yourself, all right, when is this going to be real? How about Ben Shelton? The straight set win over Thomas Mychek in his first match here in Madrid. Again, every win for Ben is an added bonus because of how poorly he performed last year during this stretch. And again, one win enough to jump him up a spot back up to his career high of number 14 in the live ranking. Still very few points to defend till really the start of the U.S. Open. So top 10 push for Ben Shelton, not an impossibility, just given where he is from a resume perspective and how much more comfortable he's starting to look on this surface as well. Tommy looked good in week number one back from injury. Shapovalov gets a couple of wins under his belt before I thought playing Zverev fairly competitively. He's just back to playing top 75 tennis again. I thought it might be a Davidovich-Fokina week. I thought for sure he was going to knock off Andrei Rublev, and when it was 8-all in the tiebreaker, I was like, yep, this is exactly where Davidovich-Fokina wants him, but again, knocked out in round three in straights. That was a little disappointing. The Runa loss, a little bit disappointing as well. That's a guy who I have very high hopes for in the clay court season. And again, really doesn't have a signature result to turn to yet. But that's everything so far on the men's side in Madrid. I would point out here quickly to end the show, a couple of really fun challengers on the calendar this week. There I say the Madrid consolation events in Aix-en-Provence. You've got top seed Adrian Mannarino, number two seed Tomas Martin Echeverri, so two top 40 guys. But you know, again, Roman Safiulin and another top 50 guy in the draw. Top 100 players like Tabilo, Vukic, Shevchenko, Roman Safiulin, Brandon Nakashima, Emil Roussevori, Arthur Rinderknecht, Van de Zandschulp, Christian Garin. It's an awesome draw. I really love the Aix-en-Provence draw, and that's an event I'm going to start talking about more as I get to catch up on those. And then, how about in Cagliari? Top seed Francis Tiafo, second seeded Lorenzo Musetti, other top 50 guys in Chris Eubanks, Lorenzo Sonego. You've got Nuno Borges, Mariano Navone, the aforementioned young Italian Luciano Darderi. It's a loaded draw, and then you've got talented young up-and-comers like Alex Mickelson, Gabe Diallo in the draw as well. So Emilio Nava, love that Cagliari draw, and again, love this week's challenger events. Those two in particular on the calendar will be two we turn our attention to more so moving forward. That said, that's your ATP update. Again, I will be back a little bit later today with an update on all things WTA Madrid. A shout out, as always, to our super producer, Daniel Westhoff, for the of an editing job he does day in, day out, making all of our content possible. A shout out and thank you as well to the support we get from our friends at Tennis Point. Remember, it's tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15. With that said, for our fantastic super producer, Daniel Westhoff, our friends at Tennis Point, from all of us here at both Crack Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. You know what we say? Hey, that's the break, and we will see you all tomorrow. Thanks, everyone.